say as much, but he has always told me when I ask the words we get wrong. I can gather the rest. It is a special kind of person who will draw together a congregation, stand up before them with a proud, clear voice, and say words wrong week after week. Bandika, for example, to kill someone. If you spit it out too quickly, as the Reverend does, it means to pinch back a plant or deflower a virgin. What a surprise it must be to the Congolese to hear that brave David, who intended to smite the mighty Goliath, was actually jumping around pinching back plants, or worse. Then there is Batiza, our father's fixed passion. Batiza, pronounced with the tongue curled just so, means baptism. Otherwise, it means to terrify. Nelson spent part of an afternoon demonstrating to me that fine linguistic difference while we scraped chicken manure from the nest boxes. No one has yet explained it to the Reverend. He is not of a mind to receive certain news. Perhaps he should clean more chicken houses. Ruth May. Sometimes you want to just lay on down and look at the whole world sideways. Mama and I do. It feels nice. If I put my head on her, the sideways world moves up and down. She goes, She's soft on her tummy and the bosom's part. When Father and Leah went away on the airplane, we just needed to lay on down a while. Sometimes I tell her, Mommy, Mommy. I just say that. Father isn't listening, so I can say it. Her real name is Mother and Mrs. Price, but her secret name to me is Mommy, Mommy. He went away on the airplane, and I said, Mama, I hope he never comes back. We cried then. But I was sad and wanted Leah to come back because she'll pick me up and carry me piggyback sometimes when she's not hollering at me for being a pest. Everybody is nice sometimes, and baby Jesus says to love everybody no matter how you really do feel. Baby Jesus knows what I said about wishing Father would never come back anymore, and Father is the preacher. So God and them love him the best. I dreamed I climbed away up to the top of the alligator pear tree and was looking down at all of them, the teeny little children with crooked cowboy legs and their big eyes looking up, and the teeniest wrapped-up babies with little hands and faces that are just as fair till they get older and turn black, for it takes a spell, I guess, before God notices they are the tribes of Ham. And the dirt-color houses, all just the same as the dirt they're sitting on. Mama says not a thing in the whole village that won't melt in a good hard rain. And I could see Mommy, Mommy, the top of her. I could see everything she was thinking like Jesus does. She was thinking about animals. Sometimes when you wake up, you can't tell if it was dreaming or real. Ada. God works, as is very well known, in mysterious ways. There is just nothing you can name that he won't do now and then. Oh, he will send down so much rain that all his little people are drinking from one another's sewers and dying of the caca-caca. Then he will organize a drought to scorch out the yam and manioc fields so whoever did not die of fever will double over from hunger. What next, you might ask? Why, a mystery, that's what. After the independence cut off our stipend and all contacts with the larger world, it seems God's plan called for Mother and Ruth May to fall sick nigh unto death. They grew flushed and spotted and thick-tongued and tired and slow-moving near unto the lower limit of what is generally thought to constitute a living human body. The Reverend seemed unconcerned about this. He forged ahead with his mission work, leaving his three older girls in charge of hearth and home for days on end, while he sallied out to visit the unsaved or to meet with Anatole about imposing Bible classes upon boys of tender years. Oh, that Bible, where every ass with a jawbone gets his day. Anatole evidently was not keen on the plan. Often the Reverend simply went out and walked along the river for hours alone, trying out his sermons on the lilies of the field, who understand him about as well as his congregation, and frankly are better listeners. All in all, being God's sole and abandoned emissary to Kalanga was keeping our father very busy. If we plagued him with our worries about Mother, he merely snapped that she would heed God's call soon enough and get herself up and around. At night, we overheard strange, tearful arguments in which Mother spoke in a quiet, slurred, slow-motion voice like a phonograph record on the wrong speed, outlining the possibilities for our family's demise. In a small fraction of the time it took her to form her plea, our father irritably countered that the Lord operates in mysterious ways, as if she did not know. Serious, delirious, imperious, wearious, deleterious ways. Our neighbors seemed fairly indifferent to our reduced circumstances as they were occupied with their own. Leah's friend Pascal was the only one who still came around occasionally, wanting Leah to come out and scout the bush for adventures with him. While we labored over changing beds or washing up dishes, Pascal would wait outside, teasing for our attention by shouting the handful of American phrases Leah had taught him. Man, oh man! Crazy! It used to make us laugh, but now we cringed for having trained him in insolence. Our childhood had passed over into history overnight. The transition was unnoticed by anyone but ourselves. The matter of giving us each day our daily bread was clearly up to us girls to figure out, and the sheer work of it exhausted me. I often felt like taking to bed myself. My sisters were similarly affected. Rachel became hollow-eyed and careworn, sometimes combing her hair only once per day. Leah slowed from a run to a walk. We had not understood what our mother had gone through to get square meals on the table for the past year. Father still didn't, as he thought nothing of leaving it in the charge of a cripple, a beauty queen, and a tomboy who approaches housework like a cat taking a bath. What a family unit we do make. Sometimes in the middle of the night, Leah would sit bolt upright in her bed wanting to talk. I think she was frightened, but she frequently brought up her vexation with Mama Mwanza, who had spoken so matter-of-factly about having a strong husband at home. It troubled Leah that people thought our household deficient, not because our mother was parked at death's door, but because we lacked a Bakala Mpandi, a strong man, to oversee us. Father doesn't hunt or fish because he has a higher calling, Leah argued from her cot, as if I might not have thought of this. Can't they see he works hard at his own profession? Had I felt like entering the discussion, I would have pointed out that to Mama Mwanza, his profession probably resembles the game of Mother May I, consisting of very long strings of nonsense words in a row. It took less than a month for our household to fall into chaos. We had to endure Father's escalating rage when he returned home to find dinner no farther along than an unresolved argument over whether there are or are not worms in the flour, or any flour at all. After his displeasure had reached a certain point, the three of us rubbed our bruises and called ourselves to a womanly sort of meeting. At the great wooden table where we had spent many a tedious hour studying algebra and the Holy Roman Empire, we now sat down to take stock. First of all, we have to keep boiling the water no matter what, announced Rachel, our elder. Write that down, Ada. If we don't boil our water for 30 full minutes, we'll get plebiscites and whatnot. Duly noted. Second of all, we have to figure out what to eat. On the pantry shelves in the kitchen house, we still had some flour, sugar, carnation milk powder, tea, 5 cans of sardines, and the underdown prunes. I recorded all this in a column in my notebook, wrote it for the benefit of my sisters, left to right. Leah added to the list mangoes, guavas, pineapples, and avocados, all of which came and went in mysterious seasons, not unlike the Lord's ways, but at least did grow in our yard free of charge. Bananas were so abundant around the village, people stole them off each other's trees in broad daylight. When Mama Mwanza's children cut down a bunch from the Nguza's big garden, Mama Nguza picked up the ones they dropped and brought them over later. Thus emboldened, Leah and I cut down a bunch the size of Ruth May from behind Eben Axelrod's outhouse while he was inside. Fruit, then, was one thing we could have without money. Oranges we had always bought at the marché, as they grew deep in the jungle and were difficult to find, but Leah claimed to know where to look. She appointed herself in charge of fruit gathering, not surprisingly, this being the category of housework that takes place farthest from a house. She pledged to collect palm nuts also, even though these taste to us exactly like candle wax, however much the Congolese children seem to prize them. Still, I wrote palm nuts in my book to prolong the list. The point of our exercise was to convince ourselves that the wolf was not actually at the back door, but perhaps merely salivating at the edge of our yard. Resting up between crucial observations, Rachel was studying the tails of her hair very closely for split ends. She resembled a cross-eyed rabbit. At the mention of palm nuts, she whined, "But you all, on a diet of just fruit, we could plumb die or even get diarrhea." "Well, what else is free?" Leah asked. "The chickens, of course," Rachel said. "We can kill those." "We couldn't kill them all," Leah explained, "because then we'd have no eggs for omelets, one of the few things we knew how to cook. But if we let some of the hens brood to increase our flock, we might get away with frying a rooster once a month or so." My sisters put me in charge of all chicken decisions, thinking me the least likely to act on a rash impulse that would cause regrets later. The rash impulse portion of my brain was destroyed at birth. We did not discuss who would be in charge of killing the unfortunate roosters. In earlier times, our mother did that with a flourish. Back when she was a happier woman, she used to claim father married her for the way she wrung a rooster's neck. Our mother used to have mystery under her skin, and we paid not the slightest attention. Next, Leah raised the difficult issue of Nelson. Nearly half our eggs went to him for his pay. We discussed whether we needed Nelson more or the eggs. There was not much now for him to cook, but he did haul our water and cut wood, and he elucidated for us the many daily mysteries of Kalanga. As I was not good at hauling water or cutting wood, I could not personally argue for a life without Nelson. My sisters, I think, had separate fears of their own. In secret ballot, we voted unanimously to keep him. "And I will bake the bread. Mother will show me how," Rachel announced, as if that finally solved all our problems. Mother had wandered unnoticed into our meeting and was standing at the front window looking out. She coughed, and we all three turned to regard her. Orleana Price, former baker of our bread. Really, she did not look like someone who could teach you how to button your shirt on straight. It's a disturbing thing after a decade of being told to tuck in shirt tails and walk like a lady to see your own mother unkempt. Feeling our silent disapproval, she turned to look at us. Her eyes had the plain blue look of a rainless sky. Empty. "It's okay, Mama," Leah said. "You can go on and lie back down if you want to." Leah had not called her Mama since we cut our first molars. Mama, nay, Orleana, came over and kissed us on the tops of our heads, then shuffled back to her deathbed. Leah turned to Rachel and hissed, "You priss, you couldn't even sift the flour." "Oh, the girl genius speaks," Rachel said, "and may I ask why not?" I chewed on my pencil and witnessed the proceedings. "No special reason," Leah said, scratching her shaggy pixie haircut behind the ear. "I'm sure you won't mind sticking your hand down in the flour bag with all those weevils and maggots in there." "There's not always maggots in the flour." "No, you're right. Sometimes the tarantulas eat them." I laughed out loud. Rachel got up and left the table. Having broken my silence in Leah's favor, though, I felt I had to scold her for the sake of balance. "If we do not all hang together," I wrote on my pad, "I know we'll all hang separately, but Rachel needs to get off her high horse, too. She's never lifted a finger around here, and now all of a sudden she's the little red hen." True enough, having Rachel in charge was very much as if Mrs. Donna Reed from television suddenly showed up to be your mother. It had to be an act. Soon she would take off her apron and turn into someone who didn't give a hoot about your general welfare. Poor tyrannical Rachel keeps trying to build a big sister career upon a slim 16-month seniority, insisting that we respect her as our elder. But Leah and I have not thought of her in that way since the second grade when we passed her up in the school spelling bee. Her downfall was the ridiculously easy word, scheme. Leah. After 3 weeks of the doldrums, I made Ruth May get out of bed. Just like that, I said, "Ruth May, honey, get up. Let's go poke around outside a while." There wasn't much to be done about Mother, but I've spent a lot of time in charge of Ruth May, and I think I should know by now what's good for her. She needed something to boss around. Our pets had mostly escaped by then or been eaten up, as in the case of Methuselah, but the Congo still offered a wealth of God's creatures to entertain us. I took Ruth May outside to get some sunshine on her, but she slumped wherever I put her with no gumption in her at all. She acted like a monkey sock doll that has been run through the machine. "Where do you think Stuart Little's gone to?" I asked her. I used that name just to please her, practically admitting it was her mongoose. She hadn't captured it or taken any special care beyond naming it after an incorrect storybook animal, namely a mouse, but I couldn't deny it followed her around. "He ran off. I don't care either." "Look a-here, Ruth May, ant lions." In the long, strange drought we were having in place of last year's rainy season, soft dust had spread across our yard in broad white patches. It was pocked all over with little funnel-shaped snares where the ant lions lay buried at the bottom, waiting for some poor insect to stumble into the trap and get devoured. We had never actually seen the ant lions themselves, only their wicked handiwork. To amuse Ruth May, I'd told her they looked like lions with six legs and were huge, as big as her left hand. I don't really know what they look like, but given how things grow in the Congo, that size seemed possible. Back before she got sick, Ruth May thought she could lie on her belly and sing to lure them out. "Wicked bug, come out of your hole," shouted in sing-song for whole afternoons at a time, even though it never worked. Ruth May's foremost personality trait was stick-to-itiveness. But now, when I suggested it, she merely turned her head to the side and laid it down in the dust. "I'm too hot to sing. They never come out anyway." I was determined to rile her up some way. If I couldn't find any spark left in Ruth May, I was afraid I might panic or cry. "Hey, watch this," I said. I found a column of ants running up a tree trunk and picked a couple out of the lineup. Bad luck for those poor ants, singled out while minding their own business amongst their brethren. Even an ant's just got its own one life to live, and I did consider this briefly as I crouched down and dropped a partly squashed ant into an ant lion's trap. They used to feed Christians to the lions, and now Ada uses that phrase ironically, referring to how I supposedly left her to be eaten up on the path. But Ada is no more Christian than an ant. We squatted over the hole and waited. The ant struggled in the soft, sandy trap until a pair of pincers suddenly reached up and grabbed it, thrashed up a little dust, and pulled it under. Gone, just like that. Don't do any more of them, Leah, Ruth May said. The ant wasn't bad. I felt embarrassed being told insect morals by my baby sister. Usually, cruelty inspired Ruth May no end, and I was just desperate to help her get her spirits back. Well, even wicked bugs have to eat, I pointed out. Everything has to eat something. Even lions, I suppose. I picked up Ruth May and dusted off her cheek. Sit in the swing and I'll comb out your pigtails, I said. I'd been carrying the comb around in my back pocket for days, meaning to get to Ruth May's hair. After I get your braids fixed up, I'll push you a while in the swing, okay? Ruth May didn't seem to have strong feelings one way or another. I sat her in the swing, which Nelson had helped us hang with a huge oily rope he found on the riverbank. The seat was an old rectangular palm oil drum. All the kids in the village used our swing. I beat some dust off the comb and began to tease out the yellow mass of knots her hair had turned into. I could hardly do it without hurting her, yet she hardly whined, which I took as a bad sign. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Anatole half hidden in the cane thicket at the edge of our yard. He wasn't cutting cane, since he doesn't chew it. I think he's a little vain of his strong white teeth with the handsome little gap in the center. But he was standing there watching us anyway, and I flushed red to think he might have seen me feeding the antlions. It seemed very childish. In the light of day, almost everything we did in Kalanga seemed childish. Even father's walking the riverbank talking to himself, and our mother drifting around half-dressed. Combing out Ruth May's hair at least seemed motherly and practical, so I concentrated on that. In spite of myself, I pictured a father with shiny black arms pulling fish from the river, and a mother with dark, heavy breasts pounding manioc in a wooden trough. Then out of habit, I fired off the repentance psalm, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according unto the multitude of thy tender mercies." But I was unsure which commandment my thoughts had broken, honor thy father and mother, or not coveting thy neighbor's parents, or even something more vague about being true to your own race and kind. Anatole started toward us. I waved and called to him, "Mbote, Anatole." "Mbote, bayene, bayene," he said. He has special names for each of my sisters and me, not the hurtful ones other people use, like Termite and Benduka for Ada, which means crooked walker. Anatole wouldn't tell us what his names meant. He tousled Ruth May's head and shook my hand in the Congolese way, with his left hand clasping his right forearm. Father said this tradition was to show they aren't hiding any weapon. "What's the news, sir?" I asked Anatole. This is what Father always said to him. In spite of how badly that first dinner had gone, Father relied greatly on Anatole and even looked forward to his visit, somewhat nervously, I think. Anatole always surprised us by knowing important news from the outside world, or from outside Kalanga, at least. We weren't sure where he got his information, but it generally turned out to be true. "A lot of news," he said, "but first I have brought you a pig in a sack." I loved hearing Anatole speak English. His pronunciation sounded British and elegant, with first coming out as fest and brought more like brought. But it sounded Congolese in the way it rolled out with equal weight on every syllable, "a pig in a sack," as if no single word wanted to take over the whole sentence. "A poke," I said. "Mother says that. Never buy a pig in a poke. I guess a poke is a sack." "Well, at any rate, it's not a pig, and you don't have to buy it. If you guess what it is, then you may have it for your dinner." On a string slung over his shoulder, he had a brown cloth sack, which he handed to me. I closed my eyes and assessed its weight, bouncing it up and down a little. It was the size of a chicken, but too heavy to be a bird. I held the bag up and examined the rounded bulge at its bottom. It had little points, possibly elbows. "Umvundla," I cried, jumping up and down like a child. This was jungle rabbit. Nelson could make a rabbit stew with mangwansi beans and mangoes that even Rachel couldn't help eating. It was that good. I'd guessed right. Anatole smiled his thrilling white smile. I can scarcely even remember how he first looked to us when we were shocked by the scars across his face. Now I could only see Anatole the man, square-shouldered and narrow-hipped in his white shirt and black trousers, Anatole with his ready smile and lively walk, a man who was kind to us. His face has many other interesting features besides the scars, such as almond-shaped eyes and a finely pointed chin. I hadn't realized how much I liked him. "Did you kill it yourself?" He held up both hands. "I would like to say yes, so you would think your friend Anatole is a good hunter. But alas, a new pupil brought it this morning to pay for his schooling." I looked in the sack. There it was, with its small furry head curled unnaturally backward due to a broken neck. It had been trapped, not shot. I clasped the sack to my chest and looked up at Anatole sideways. "Would you really have taken it back if I hadn't guessed right?" He smiled. "I would have given you a lot of chances to guess right." "Well, is that the kind of leniency you show your boys on their math and French in school? They must never learn anything." Oh, no, miss. I crack their naughty heads with a stick and send them home in disgrace. We both laughed. I knew better. Please come for dinner tonight, Anatole. With this rabbit, we'll have too much to eat. In fact, this lonely rabbit would make a small stew, and we would still be hungry while we washed the dishes afterward, a feeling we were trying to get used to. But that was how people said thank you in Kalunga. I'd learned a few manners, at least. Perhaps I will, he said. We'll make a stew, I promised. Mangwansi beans are high in the marché, he pointed out, because of the drought. All the gardens are drying up. I happen to know who has some, Mama Nguza. She makes her kids haul water up from the creek to pour on her garden. Haven't you seen it? It's sensational. No, I have not seen this sensation. I will have to make better friends with Tata Nguza. I don't know about him. He sure doesn't talk to me. Nobody talks to me, Anatole. Poor Bayeni. It's true, I don't have a single solitary friend here but Nelson and Pascal, two little boys. And you. All the girls my age have their own babies and are too busy. And the men act like I'm a snake fixing to bite them. He shook his head, laughing. They do so, Anatole. Yesterday I was sitting in the weeds watching Tata Mwanza make fish traps, and when I stood up and asked him to show me how, he ran away and jumped in the water. I swear it. Biene, you were naughty. Tata Mwanza could not be seen talking to a young woman. You know that. It would be a scandal. I said. Why was it scandalous for me to converse with any man in Kalunga old enough to have a whole seat in his pants, except for Anatole? But I didn't ask. I didn't want to jinx our friendship. What I do happen to know, I said, being maybe a tiny bit coy, is that a civet cat got all of the Nguza's hens last Sunday. So Mama Nguza will be in a mood to trade Mangwansi beans for eggs, don't you think? Anatole smiled enormously. Clever girl. I smiled, too, but didn't know what else to say after that. I felt embarrassed and returned to combing out Ruth May's hair. She appears to be a very glum little girl today, Anatole said. She's been sick in bed for weeks. Mother has, too. Didn't you notice when you came by the other day how she was standing out on the porch just staring into space? Father says they'll both be all right, but... I shrugged. It wouldn't be the sleeping sickness, do you think? I think no. Now is not the season for tsetse flies. There's hardly any sleeping sickness at all in Kalunga right now. Well, that's good, because what I've heard about sleeping sickness is you die of it, I said, still combing, feeling like someone who's been hypnotized into that one single motion. Sleeping in her braids for sweaty days and nights on end had creased Ruth May's dark blonde hair into shining waves like water. Anatole stared at it as I combed it down her back. His smile got lost somewhere in that quiet minute. There is news, Biene, since you asked for it. I'm afraid it is not very good. I came to talk to your father. He's not here. I can tell him whatever it is, though. I wondered if Anatole would consider me a sufficient messenger. I'd noticed Congolese men didn't treat even their own wives and daughters as if they were very sensible or important, though as far as I could see, the wives and daughters did just about all the work. But Anatole apparently felt I could be spoken to. Do you know where Katanga province is? In the south, I said, where all the diamond mines are. I'd overheard talk of it when Mr. Axelrooth flew father and me back from Leopoldville. Evidently, Mr. Axelrooth went there often. So I was guessing, but I guessed with my father's trademark confidence. Diamonds, yes, Anatole said, also cobalt and copper and zinc. Everything my country has that your country wants. This made me feel edgy. Did we do something bad? Not you, Bene. Not me, not me. My heart rejoiced at that, though I couldn't say why. But yes, there is a bad business going on, he said. Do you know the name of Moise Shombe? I might have heard it, but wasn't sure. I started to nod, but then admitted no. I decided right then to stop pretending I knew more than I did. I would be myself, Leah Price, eager to learn all there is to know. Watching my father, I've seen how you can't learn anything when you're trying to look like the smartest person in the room. Moise Shombe is the leader of the Lunda tribe. For all practical purpose, he is the leader of Katanga province. And since a few days ago, leader of his own nation of Katanga, he declared it separate from the Republic of Congo. What? Why? Now he can make his own business with the Belgians and Americans, you see, with all his minerals. Some of your countrymen have given a lot of encouragement to his decision. Why can't they just make their deals with Lumumba? He's the one that got elected. They ought to know that. They know, but Lumumba is not eager to give away the store. His loyalty is with his countrymen. He believes in a unified Congo for the Congolese, and he knows that every Katanga diamond from the south can pay a teacher's salary in Leopoldville or feed a village of Waraga children in the north. I felt both embarrassed and confused. Why would the businessmen take Congo's diamonds away? And what are Americans doing down there anyhow? I thought the Congo belonged to Belgium. I mean before. Anatole frowned. The Congo is the Congo's, and ever has been.
Well, I know that, but...
Open your eyes, Bienni. Look at your neighbors. Did they ever belong to Belgium? He pointed across our yard and through the trees toward Mama Mwanza's house. I'd said a stupid thing and felt terrible. I looked as he commanded. Mama Mwanza, with her disfigured legs and her small, noble head both wrapped in bright yellow calico. In the hard-packed dirt, she sat as if planted there in front of a little fire that licked at her dented cooking can. She leaned back on her hands and raised her face to the sky, shouting her bidding, and a chorus of half-hearted answers came back from her boys inside the mud-thatch house. Near the open doorway, the two older daughters stood pounding manioc in the tall wooden mortar. As one girl raised her pounding club, the other girls went down into the narrow hole, up and down, a perfect, even rhythm like the pumping of pistons. I'd watched them time and again, attracted so to that dance of straight backs and muscled black arms. I envied these daughters who worked together in such perfect synchrony. It's what Ada and I might have felt if we hadn't gotten all snared in the ropes of guilt and unfair advantage. Now our whole family was at odds, it seemed. Mother against father, Rachel against both of them, Ada against the world, Ruth May pulling helplessly at anyone who came near, and me trying my best to stay on father's side. We were tangled in such knots of resentment we hardly understood them. Two of her children died in the epidemic, I said. I know. Of course he knew. Our village was small and Anatole knew every child by name. It's a terrible shame, I offered inadequately. He merely agreed. Yay. Children should never have to die. No, but if they never did, children would not be so precious. Anatole, would you say that if your own children died? Of course not, but it is true, nevertheless. Also, if everyone lived to be old, then old age would not be such a treasure. But everybody wants to live a long time. It's only fair. Fair to want, yay. But not fair to get. Just think how it would be if all the great-grandparents still were walking around. The village would be crowded with cross old people arguing over who has the most ungrateful sons and aching bones and always eating up food before the children could get to the table. Sounds like a church social back in Georgia, I said. Anatole laughed. Mama Mwanza shouted again and clapped her hands, bringing a reluctant son out of the house, dragging the flat pinkish soles of his feet. Then I laughed too, just because people young and old are more or less the same everywhere. I let myself breathe out, feeling less like one of Anatole's schoolboys taking a scolding. Do you see that, Bienni? That is Congo. Not minerals and glittering rocks with no hearts, these things that are traded behind our backs. The Congo is us. I know. Who owns it, do you suppose? I did not hazard a guess. I am sorry to say those men making their agreements in Katanga just now are accustomed to getting what they want. I drew the edge of the comb slowly down the center of Ruth May's head, making a careful part. Father had said the slums outside Leopoldville would be set right by American aid after independence. Maybe I was foolish to believe him. There were shanties just as poor in Georgia, on the edge of Atlanta, where black and white divided, and that was smack in the middle of America. "Can you just do that, what they did down there, announce your own country?" I asked. "Prime Minister Lumumba says no, absolutely not. He has asked the United Nations to bring an army to restore unity. Is there going to be a war? There is already a kind of war, I think. Moise Tshombe has Belgians and mercenary soldiers working for him. I don't think they will leave without a fight. And Katanga is not the only place where they are throwing stones. There is a different war in Matadi, Teesville, Bouende, Leopoldville. People are very angry at the Europeans. They are even hurting women and little children. What are they so mad at the white people for?" Anatole sighed. "Those are big cities. Where the boa and the hen curl up together, there is only trouble. People have seen too much of the Europeans and all the things they had. They imagined after independence life would immediately become fair. Can't they be patient? Could you be? If your belly was empty and you saw whole baskets of bread on the other side of a window, would you continue waiting patiently, Bienni, or would you throw a rock?" "My belly is empty," I thought of telling Anatole. "I don't know," I confessed. I thought of the Underdown's home in Leopoldville with its Persian rugs and silver tea service and chocolate cookies surrounded by miles of tin shanties and hunger. Perhaps there were boys stomping barefoot through that house right now, ransacking the near-empty pantry and setting fire to the curtains in a kitchen that still smelled of Mrs. Underdown's disinfectant soap.
I couldn't say who was right or wrong. I did see what Anatole meant about the snakes and hens too close together in a place like that. You could trace the belly scales of hate and come up howling. I glanced nervously at our own house with no rugs or tea service, but how much did that matter? Would Jesus protect us? When he looked in our hearts to weigh our worth, would he find love for the Congolese neighbors or disdain? Well, it's the job of the United Nations to keep the peace, I said. When will they come? That is what everybody would like to know. If they won't come, the Prime Minister has threatened to ask Mr. Khrushchev for help. Khrushchev, I said, trying to cover my shock, the communists would help the Congo? Oh, yes, I think they would, Anatole eyed me strangely. Bien-Aimé, do you know what a communist is? I know they do not fear the Lord, and they think everybody should have the same... I found I couldn't complete my own sentence. The same kind of house, more or less, Anatole finished for me. That is about right. Well, I want the United Nations to come right away and fix it up so everything's fair this minute. Anatole laughed at me. I think you are a very impatient girl, eager to grow up into an impatient woman. I blushed. Don't worry about Mr. Khrushchev. When Lumumba says he might get help from Russia, it is, what do you call this? Il prend son monde, like the hen who puffs up her feathers like so, very big, to show the snake she is too big to eat. A bluff, I said, delighted. Lumumba's bluffing. A bluff, exactly. I think Lumumba wants to be neutral more than anything, more than he loves his very own life. He doesn't want to give away our wealth, but he most especially does not want your country for an enemy. He has a hard job, I said. I can think of no person in all the world right now with a harder job. Mr. Axelrod doesn't think much of him, I confessed. He says Patrice Lumumba is trouble in a borrowed suit. Anatole leaned close to my ear. Do you want to know a secret? I think Mr. Axelrod is trouble in his own stinking hat. Oh, I laugh to hear that. We stood a while longer watching Mama Mwanza argue good-naturedly with her lazy son and take several broad swipes at him with her big cooking spoon. He jumped back, making exaggerated shouts. His sisters scolded him, too, laughing. I realized that Mama Mwanza had an extraordinarily pretty face, with wide-set eyes, a solemn mouth, and a high, rounded forehead under her kerchief. Her husband had taken no other wife, even after her terrible accident and the loss of their two youngest children. Their family had seen so much of hardship, yet it still seemed easy for them to laugh with each other. I envied them with an intensity near to love and near to rage. I told Anatole, I saw Patrice Lumumba, did you know that? In Leopoldville, my father and I got to watch him give his inaugural speech. Did you? Anatole seemed impressed. Well, then, you can make up your own mind. What did you think of our Prime Minister? It took me a moment's pause to discover what I thought. Finally, I said, I didn't understand everything, but he made me want to believe in every word, even the ones I wasn't sure of. You understood well enough, then. Anatole, is Katanga close to here? He flipped his finger against my cheek. Don't worry, Biene. No one will be shooting at you. Go and cook your rabbit. I'll come back when I can smell Umvundla stew from my desk in the schoolhouse. Sala Mbote. Wenda Mbote. I clasped my forearm and shook his hand. I called to his back as he walked away. Thank you, Anatole. I wasn't just thanking him for the rabbit, but also for telling me things. For the way he said, not you, Biene, and you understood well enough. He turned and walked backwards for a few bouncing steps. Don't forget to tell your father. Katanga has seceded. I won't possibly forget. I returned to Ruth May's braids, but was very conscious of Anatole's broad shoulders and narrow waist, the triangle of white shirt moving away from us as he walked purposefully down the dirt road back to the village. I wish the people back home reading magazine stories about dancing cannibals could see something as ordinary as Anatole's clean white shirt and kind eyes, or Mama Mwanza with her children. If the word Congo makes people think of that big-lipped cannibal man in the cartoon, why, they're just wrong about everything here from top to bottom. But how could you ever set them right? Since the day we arrived, Mother has nagged us to write letters home to our classmates at Bethlehem High, and not one of us has done it yet. We're still wondering, where do you start? This morning, I got up. I'd begin. But no, This morning, I pull back the mosquito netting that's tucked in tight around our beds because mosquitoes here give you malaria, a disease that runs in your blood, which nearly everyone has anyway, but they don't go to the doctor for it because there are worse things like sleeping sickness or the kaka-kaka, or that someone has put a kibaatsu on them. And anyway, there's really no doctor nor money to pay one, so people just hope for the good luck of getting old because then they'd be treasured. And meanwhile, they go on with their business because they have children they love and songs to sing while they work, And you wouldn't even get as far as breakfast before running out of paper. You'd have to explain the words and then the words for the words. Ruth May remained listless while I explored my thoughts and finished up her braids. I knew I ought to have bathed her and washed her hair before combing it out, but the idea of lugging the big tub out and heating a dozen tea kettles of water so she wouldn't get chilled, it was more than a day's work, and now I had mungwansi beans to worry about and the skinning of a rabbit. That is surely childhood's end, when you look at a thing like a rabbit needing skinned and have to say, nobody else is going to do this. So, no bath for Ruth May that day. I merely pushed her a while in the swing as I'd promised, and she did kick her feet a little. Maybe it made her happy, I can't say. I hope it did. Anatole's words had pushed things around inside of me. It's true that sickness and death make children more precious. I used to threaten Ruth May's life so carelessly just to make her behave. Now I had to face the possibility that we really could lose her, and my heart felt like a soft, damaged place in my chest, like a bruise on a peach. She flew forward and back, and I watched her shadow in the white dust under the swing. Each time she reached the top of her arc beneath the sun, her shadow legs were transformed into the thin, curved legs of an antelope, with small, rounded hooves at the bottom instead of feet. I was transfixed and horrified by the image of my sister with antelope legs. I knew it was only shadow in the angle of the sun, but still, it's frightening when things you love appear suddenly changed from what you have always known. Ruth May. All those black faces in the black night are looking at me. They want me to come play. But you can't say the words out loud at night, Mother, may I? No, you may not. Mama says no. Mama's here, breathing. When we're both asleep, I hear her talk, and that's what she says. No, 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 no. But the lizards run away up the walls with the rest of her words, and I can't hear. Sometimes I wake up and nobody. Outside there's sunshine, so I know it's broad day, but everybody's gone, and I'm sweating too much and can't talk about it. Other times it's dark, and Mama and Father are saying secrets. Mama begs Father. She says they went after the white girls up in Stanleyville. They went in their houses and took everything they wanted to, the food and the radio batteries and all. And they made the missionaries stand naked on top of the roof without any clothes on. And then they shot two of them. Everybody's talking about it, and Mama heard. In Stanleyville is where the doctor put a cast on my arm. Did he have to go on the roof of the hospital without any clothes? I never can stop thinking about the doctor with no clothes on. The lizards run away up the wall and take all the words I want to say. But Father says what the Bible says, the meek shall inherit. He started to put his hand on Mama, and she pushed him away. Hearken therefore unto the supplications of thy servant, that thine eyes may be opened toward this house, night and day. Night and day, night and day. Jesus is looking right in the windows no matter what. He can see through the roof. He can see inside our heads where we think the bad things. I tried not to think of the doctor with no clothes on with all of them up on the roof, but he had that yellow hair on his arms. Rachel screamed and thrashed her white hair and sassed back at Father bad. Who cares? Who cares? Who cares? Who's even going to know the difference if we scoot out of here and go home where it's safe? Father yelled, God will know the difference. And Rachel fell down hard before I even heard the sound of the wall in his hand. God despises a coward who runs while others stand and suffer. Where will we be safe? When Mama raises her eyes up to him, they are so cold there isn't even any Mama home inside there. And she says, Nathan Price, the meek shall inherit. You wait and see. I know the meek shall inherit and the last shall be first, but the tribes of Ham were last. Now will they be first? I don't know. In our family, Mama comes last. Ada's next to last because her one whole side is bad, and then comes Mama last of all because something in her is even worse hurt than what Ada's got. Nelson told me how to find a safe place. One time I woke up and there he was, Nelson. Oh, is he mad because I tried to see him naked? I don't know. My mouth couldn't say any words, but there he was by the bed and Mama gone from beside me. He put his hand over my mouth, stooping down, and nobody else there. Nobody else. Shh, he said, and put his hand. I thought he was going to hurt me, but instead he was my friend.
Shh, he said,
and took his hand off my mouth and gave me a present. Abu Bandu, take this. Bandu is my name, Nomo Bandu. It means the littlest one on the bottom, and it means the reason for everything. Nelson told me that.
What is it?
I said, but not any words came out of my mouth. I looked inside my two hands where he put it, and there was a tiny box like what matches come in, a matchbox. The matchbox had a picture of a lion on the outside, and I thought there would be a tiny little lion inside to be my pet, like the mean ones that eat the ants, only nicer, Stuart Lion. But no, Nelson opened it up and took out something I couldn't tell what. It looked like a piece of chicken bone with gristle and string all on it and sticky and something black. What was it, something that died? I was scared and started fixing to cry. Nelson said, don't be scared. He said, this has been in the magic fire. You call this Nkisi. He made me touch it, and it didn't burn me. Look, he said. He held it right up to my eye. There was a tiny hole in the side and a tiny peg that fit in the hole tied with string. Put your spirit inside here, he said. Here, quick, blow in this hole. He opened up the peg, and I blew in the little hole, and quick, he said, my name, Nomo Bandu, Nomo Bandu, Nomo Bandu, and shut up the hole with the little peg, and now you're safe. He said, now if anything happens to me, if I start fixing to die or something, hold on to this tight, and bambala, Ruth May will disappear. How do you know? But Nelson knows everything about dead people. His mama and father and brothers and baby sister are all dead on the bottom of the river. I don't want to disappear, I said. But he said, only if you're going to die. He said, this way I won't die. I'll just disappear for a second, and then I'll turn up someplace else where it's safe. Instead of dead, I'll be safe. But first I have to think of that place every day so my spirit will know where to run away to when it's time. You have to think of your safe place every day. Nelson's face was bigger than a candle right in my face, and I could hear the good way he smelled. The soap that he uses for washing up in his clothes, all those smells were so loud in my ears. Nelson is my friend that showed me how to sing to the chickens. Bidamuka is the magic name of a chicken. Nobody else knows that, not even Leah or father. Nelson said, don't forget. I put the matchbox with the lion picture on it and the magic burned bones inside. I put it under my pillow. Nkisi. Sometimes I wake up and it's still there. If they come and try to make me go up on the roof naked, I'll just disappear and turn up some whole other place. But first, I have to think of where I'll go. I can feel the box in my hand. My pillow is wet and the tiny little box is soft, but I know what's inside. Secret. There's the window, and it's daytime now, and people in the other room talking, and they don't know I have a secret. But Nelson has gone somewhere, and his mama dead. I wonder where. And I can't remember the song we sang to the chickens. Leah. Ruth May's sickness stayed with her, but Mother began pulling herself together. Seeing the two of them curled in the same bed, one slowly emerging and the other losing ground, put me back onto familiar, unpleasant thoughts of Ada and me in the womb. I have prayed 1,000 times for God to tell me, did I do that to Ada? If I showed her more kindness now, could I be forgiven for making her a cripple? But a debt of that size seems so impossible to pay back, it's a dread thing even to start on. Mother used her own reserves without stealing the life out of Ruth May or anyone else. She seemed to draw strength right out of the muggy air. Sometimes I saw her sit on the side of the bed for a while before getting up, drawing in deep breaths through thin, pursed lips. She had her good and bad phases, but finally stopped sleepwalking once and for all. It happened rather suddenly one day after Rachel burned up an egg omelet. She burned 2 in a row, to be exact. She had the fire in the stove stoked up way too high. The only way to get a slow heat for baking bread or cooking a tender thing like an omelet is to build up a big fire first with good stout wood and then cook while the coals die slowly down. Rachel could never get the hang of that. She was trying to start the fire and cook all at once, which will never get you anywhere. You can't keep a new fire low. It must grow or die. Nelson taught me that. But Nelson had gone to get water before dark, so Rachel was trying to cook all alone. It was her day in charge of dinner, and she had failed to think ahead. Now I could hear her screaming vile things out there in the kitchen house. I went out to investigate and let her know we were hungry. "I'll hungry you," she yelled. "Can't you see I've only got 2 hands? I could. She was using both of them to gouge at the burned skillet with a wooden spatula of Nelson's making. Her hair had come down from its French knot and stuck all over her face, and her good blouse was smeared with black ash. She looked like Cinderella in reverse, stepped out from her life at the ball for a day of misery among the ashes. You've built the fire up way too hot, I told her. Go to hell, Leah. Just go straight, directly to hell. I'm just trying to help. Look, see how the metal's glowing red hot on top? When it gets like that, you just have to wait and let it cool off. Then you can try again. Rachel blew out her breath hard. Oh, whatever would I do without my child progeny sister to tell me what to do? Prodigy, I corrected. Shut up, damn it! I wish you'd just shut up forever like your goddamn deaf-mute genius twin. She whirled around and threw the spatula, not missing my head by all that wide a margin. It banged loudly on the back door of the main house. I was shocked, not so much by her language, but by the strength of that pitch. Usually Rachel threw underhanded and was no threat at all. Oh, P.S., Leah, there's no more eggs, she added with satisfaction, for your information. Well, we have to eat something. I guess we'll just eat the burnt ones. This? Oh, I'm sure. I'd rather die than have to serve this to Father. She made a horrible face at the pan and gave it a vicious shake. This adventure in fine dining looks like it's been drugged through hell backwards. Rachel looked up at me and clapped her left hand over her mouth. I turned around. There was Mother in the doorway behind me, holding up the spatula. Rachel, Mother said, I believe you dropped this. We stood frozen before the altar of a red-hot cook stove. Rachel took the spatula without a word. Rachel, sugar, let me tell you something. I understand you're miserable, but I'm afraid this is your penance for 16 years of pulling up your nose at my cooking. I want to see you bring that mess in here and serve it up to your father and all the rest of us, including yourself, and I want to see you clean your own plate without one word. Tomorrow I'll start teaching you how to cook. Mother kept her promise. She'd gotten up changed from her month in bed. For one thing, she was now inclined to say whatever was on her mind right in front of God and everybody, even Father. She didn't speak to him directly. It was more like she was talking straight to God, or the air, or the lizards who'd paused halfway up the walls, and if Father should overhear her, that was his nickel. She declared she was taking us out of here as soon as she found the way to do it. She had even asked Eben Axelrod flat out if he would take us. Not at the moment, was his reply, since he'd probably get shot down over Leopoldville with a plane load of white ladies, and he didn't want to make that kind of headlines. But on another day, he came back smiling sideways and confided to Mama that every man has his price. From the looks of Mama, she means to pay it. I was shocked and frightened to see her flout Father's authority, but truthfully, I could feel something similar moving around in my own heart. For the first time in my life, I doubted his judgment. He'd made us stay here when everybody from Nelson to the King of Belgium was saying white missionaries ought to go home. For us to be here now each day was Father's decision and his alone. Yet he wasn't providing for us, but only lashing out at us more and more. He wasn't able to protect Mother and Ruth May from getting sick. If it's all up to him to decide our fate, shouldn't protection be part of the bargain? I wanted to believe in him. We had much more of the Lord's work to do here, that was plain. And what better time to do it, Father had told me reasonably on the plane coming back from Leopoldville, than in the festive atmosphere of independence, when all Congolese are free to learn from us and make their own choices. Father believes they will choose the Lord's infinite love. And us, of course, as we are God's special delegation to Kalanga. He says we're being brave and righteous. Bravery and righteousness, those are two things that cannot go unrewarded in the sight of the Lord. Father never doubts it, and I can see that for him it's true. He's lived all his days by the laws of Christ, standing up tall and starting to preach in tent revivals when he was hardly older than I am now. And for all that time, people flocked to his word and his wisdom. He was brave in the war, I'm sure, for he won a Purple Heart. For Father, the kingdom of the Lord is an uncomplicated place where tall, handsome boys fight on the side that always wins. I suppose it resembles Kildare, Mississippi, where Father grew up and played the position of quarterback in high school. In that kind of a place, it is even all right for people to knock into each other hard every once in a while, in a sportsmanlike way, leaving a few bruises in the service of the final score. But where is the place for girls in that kingdom? The rules don't quite apply to us, nor protect us either. What do a girl's bravery and righteousness count for, unless she's also pretty? Just try being the smartest and most Christian seventh-grade girl in Bethlehem, Georgia. Your classmates will smirk and call you a square. Call you worse if you're Ada. All my life I've tried to set my shoes squarely into his footprints, believing if I only stayed close enough to him, those same clean, simple laws would rule my life as well, that the Lord would see my goodness and fill me with light. Yet with each passing day, I find myself farther away. There's a great holy war going on in my Father's mind in which we're meant to duck and run and obey orders and fight for all the right things, but I can't always make out the orders or even tell which side I'm on exactly. I'm not even allowed to carry a gun. I'm a girl. He has no inkling. If his decision to keep us here in the Congo wasn't right, then what else might he be wrong about? It has opened up in my heart a sickening world of doubts and possibilities where before I had only faith in my father and love for the Lord. Without that rock of certainty underfoot, the Congo is a fearsome place to have to sink or swim. Rachel. I was in the kitchen house slaving over a hot stove when everybody came running by. All the raggedy little children with the mothers right behind them, all hollering, "Ta-ta bidi bidi, ta-ta bidi bidi." That means Mr. Bird, according to Leah, who ran right out to join them. If Mr. Bird, whosoever that might be, was going to put in an appearance, Leah sure wasn't going to miss it. They were saying he'd come up the river in some kind of old boat and was down there unloading his family and whatnot. Being the new Chef Boyardee of the Price family, I had no time for fun and games. The only way I'd ever find out what was up in Kalanga nowadays was if it passed by the door of our kitchen house. Well, turns out I didn't have to wait too long, for they made straight for our doorstep. What to our wondering eyes should appear out there on the porch but a white man, very old and skinny, wearing a denim shirt so old you could practically see through it, and a little wooden cross hanging on a leather string around his neck, the way the Congolese wear their evil eye fetishes. He had a white beard and twinkly blue eyes, and all in all gave the impression of what Santa Claus would look like if he'd converted to Christian and gone without a good meal since last Christmas. When I got out to the porch, he was already shaking hands with Mother and introducing his wife, a tall Congolese woman, and their children, who were variable in age and color, but mostly were hiding behind the long, colorful skirts of Miss Bird. Mother was confused, but she always has the good manners to be hospitalizing even to perfect strangers, so she asked the men and told me to run squeeze some orange juice. So back to the kitchen for Rachel the slave. By the time I got back with a big dripping jar of orange juice and flopped down in a chair to rest, I'd already missed everything. I couldn't say what or who they were, but yet here was Mother yakking it up with them like old home week. They sat in our living room chairs asking about people in the village like they knew their way around. "Mama Mwanza, oh, how is she? Mama Lo is still doing coiffure and pressing palm oil. Bless her heart, she must be 110 and she never married at all. That just goes to show you. Now, Mama Tataba, where is she? Oh, but Anatole, we'd better go see him at once." That kind of thing. Reverend Santa seemed like a kindly old man. The way he talked sounded part Yankee, part foreign, like one of those friendly Irish policemen in the old movies. Oh, mind you. Ruth May, who'd been up out of bed for a few days and seemed to be on the mend, was so enraptured with him she sat with her head practically leaning up against his worn-out trousers. The old man rested a hand on Ruth May's head and listened very closely to everything Mother said, nodding thoughtfully in a way that was quite complimentary. His wife was approximately 100 years younger than him and attractive in her own way and was mostly quiet. But she could speak English perfectly. They asked how things were going down at the church. Father was out somewhere looking for trouble, as usual, and we hardly knew how to answer that question ourselves. Mother said, "Well, it's difficult. Nathan's very frustrated. It's all so clear to him that the words of Jesus will bring grace to their lives. But people here have such different priorities from what we're used to." "They are very religious people, you know," the old man said, "for all that." "How do you mean?" Mother asked. "Everything they do is with one eye to the Spirit. When they plant their yams and manioc, they're praying. When they harvest, they're praying. Even when they conceive their children, I think they're praying." Mother seemed very interested, but Leah crossed her arms and asked, "Do you mean praying to their own pagan gods?" Reverend Santa smiled at Leah. "What do you imagine our God thinks of this little corner of his creation? The flowering trees in the forest, the birds, the drenching downpours, the heat of the sun. Do you know what I'm talking about?" "Oh, yes," Leah said, straight-A pupil as always. "And do you think God is pleased with these things?" "Oh, I think he glories in them," she hastened to say. "I think he must be prouder of the Congo than just about any place he ever made." "I think so, too," he said. "I think the Congolese have a world of God's grace in their lives, along with a dose of hardship that can kill a person entirely. I happen to think they already knew how to make a joyful noise unto the Lord a long time ago." Leah leaned back in her chair, probably wondering what Father would say to that, as if we didn't know. He'd say the Irish and them are well known to be Catholic papists and worshippers of the false idols. The business about the flowers and the little birdies just clinches the deal. "Have you heard the songs they sing here in Kalanga?" he asked. "They're very worshipful. It's a grand way to begin a church service, singing a Congolese hymn to the rainfall on the seed yams. It's quite easy to move from there to the parable of the mustard seed. Many parts of the Bible make good sense here if only you change a few words. He laughed. And a lot of whole chapters, sure, you just have to throw away. Well, it's every bit God's word, isn't it? Leah said. God's word, brought to you by a crew of romantic idealists in a harsh desert culture eons ago, followed by a chain of translators 2,000 years long. Leah stared at him. Darling, did you think God wrote it all down in the English of King James himself? No, I guess not. Think of all the duties that were perfectly obvious to Paul or Matthew in that old Arabian desert that are pure nonsense to us now. All that foot washing, for example. Was it really for God's glory or just to keep the sand out of the house? Leah sat narrow-eyed in her chair, for once stumped for the correct answer. Oh, and the camel. Was it a camel that could pass through the eye of a needle more easily than a rich man? Or a coarse piece of yarn? The Hebrew words are the same, but which one did they mean? If it's a camel, the rich man might as well not even try. But if it's the yarn, he might well succeed with a lot of effort, you see? He leaned forward toward Leah with his hands on his knees. Oh, I shouldn't be messing about with your thinking this way, with your father out in the garden. But I'll tell you a secret. When I want to take God at his word exactly, I take a peep out the window at his creation, because that, darling, he makes fresh for us every day, without a lot of dubious middle managers. Leah didn't commit herself one way or the other. The flowers and birds and all, you mean to say that's your gospel? Ah, you're thinking I'm a crazy old pagan for sure. Old Tata Bird laughed heartily, fingering the cross around his neck, another warning sign of Catholic papism, and he didn't sound repentant. No, I understand, Mother said thoughtfully. She appeared to understand him so well she'd like to adopt him and have his mixed-race family move right in. You'll have to forgive me. I've been here so long. I've come to love these people here and their ways of thinking. That goes without saying, I thought, given his marital situation. Well, you must be famished, Mother said suddenly, jumping up out of her chair. Stay for dinner, at least. Nathan should be home soon. Do you actually live on that little boat? We do, in fact. It's a good home base for doing our work, a little collecting, a little nature study, a little ministry, a little public health and dispensing of the quinine. Our older children stay in Leopoldville most of the year for their schooling, but they've come with us on a little holiday to visit the relatives. He glanced at his wife, who smiled. She explained quietly. Tata Fowles is especially interested in the birds. He has classified many kinds in this region that were never known before by Europeans. Tata Fowles? Where had I heard that name before? I was racking my brain while Mother and the Mrs. began an oh-so-polite argument about whether the family would stay for dinner. Mother apparently forgot we didn't have one decent thing fit to eat, and little did that family know what they were in for if they stayed. Tata Fowles, I kept turning that over. Meanwhile, Ada pulled her chair up next to him and opened one of the old musty bird books she'd found in this house, which she adores to carry around. Oh, he cried happily, I'd forgotten those books entirely. How wonderful you're putting them to use. But you have to know I've many better ones down on the boat. Ada looked like she'd love to just run down there and read them all backwards right this minute. She was pointing out different pictures of long-tailed squawk jays and whatnot, and he was so bubbling over with information that he probably failed to notice Ada can't talk. Oh, I suddenly thought to myself, Brother Fowles, that Brother Fowles, the minister who had this mission before us and got kicked out for consorting with the natives too much. Well, I should say so. Now everything fell into place. But it was too late for me to say anything, having missed the introductions on account of being the maidservant. I just sat there while Ada got bird lessons and Leah cajoled the shy little Fowles children to come in off the porch and sit on the floor with her and Ruth May and read comic books with them. Then suddenly the room went dark, for Father was at the door. We all froze, except for Brother Fowles, who jumped up and held out his hand to Father with the left hand clasping his forearm, secret handshake of the Congolese. Brother Price, at last, he said, I've held you in my prayers, and now I've had the blessing of meeting your lovely family. I'm Brother Fowles, your predecessor in this mission, my wife Celine, our children. Father didn't offer his hand. He was studying that big Catholic-looking cross around the neck and probably thinking over all we'd heard about Brother Fowles going off the deep end, plus every curse word ever uttered by the parrot. Finally, he did shake hands, but in a cool way, American style. What brings you back here? Ah, we were passing this way. We do most of our work downriver near the Qua, but my wife's parents are at Ganda. We thought we might look in on you and our other friends in Kalunga. Sure, we should pay our respects to Tata Ndu. You could see Father's skin crawl when he heard the name of his archenemy, the chief, spoken in a Yank accent to boot. But Father played the cool cat, not admitting what a miserable failure he'd been so far at the Christianizing trade. "We're just fine and dandy, thank you, and what work is it you do now?" He emphasized the now as if to say, "We know very well you got kicked out of preaching the gospel." "I rejoice in the work of the Lord," said Brother Fowles. "I was just telling your wife I do a little ministering. I study and classify the fauna. I observe a great deal and probably offer very little salvation in the long run." "That is a pity,"